This is Golf Nuts with Aaron Abrams and Jimmy James. Hi, Jimmy.
Hey, Aaron. So we've done a few of these now, and they've been with people that either I knew and had a relationship with, or you knew and had a relationship with. Today, I'm looking forward to our discussion with Mario Guerra, who we both know. And so this is the first one where we're going to talk to someone that we both, that we have a relationship with independently and together.
Yeah, I don't want to, oversell and under deliver here, but, Mario is a great guy, and it's really a pleasure to spend some time with him and hear his story. I've never really had the opportunity to really do it. I've known him for a number of years now. And I've heard bits and pieces of the story, but I'm so happy to hear the whole thing together.
Yeah, he really is just a solid guy. Both of us have met some really great people throughout our golf travels, and he is really just an all around good guy. And hopefully, when we talk to him today, we'll have an opportunity to talk about how he and I met, and how all of us sort of connected through the game of golf.
Absolutely. Well, without further ado, let's bring on another golf nut, Mario Guerra. Well, hello everyone. This is Aaron Abrams and Jimmy James for another edition episode of the Golf Nuts, or Golf Nut, I guess we're calling ourselves. And we have quite a golf nut today in our friend Mario Guerra. I'm going to try to channel my high school Spanish there and get that out. And, Mario is going to tell us his story today, which Jimmy and I both know is extraordinary, but haven't quite heard all the details. And so we're excited to actually hear it for our first time as well. But I'll tell you where the story ends just before we get started. So Mario is I think a 33 years old, right, Mario? You got the job.
That's right.
Head
That's
pro
correct.
At a top 100 golf course, Quaker Ridge Golf Course, which is an outstanding Tillinghast course and in the top 100 consistently for many, many decades. And Mario got that job, and he is one of the highest ranked instructors in New York, and is always on the best young teacher list and so forth. He competes in very high end tournaments like the Met Open, Met Amateur, but here's the kicker. He did not start playing golf, had never touched a golf club until he was 20 years old. So in a 13-year period, he went from not touching a golf club to being the pro at a top 100 golf course, and at the head pro, mind you. Anyhow, so we'll get started. Jimmy, maybe you could kick the questions off today.
So Mario, you and I had a serendipitous meeting there on Griffin Street that maybe at some point we'll get into, but that gave me the sense that you and I were very much kindred spirits. So I think my life's been an interesting journey, but I know yours has been even more interesting. So why don't you tell us how you got started on the journey that got you to where you are today?
Absolutely. Gentlemen, it's so good to be on this podcast. Once you invited me and then you told me the name, I knew I was, I qualified, because I definitely consider myself a golf nut. So Aaron and Jimmy, thank you so much for creating this podcast, for inviting me to be on it. I can't start my story without going back to Cuba. I was born in Cuba in 1984, and golf is non-existent in Cuba. Is that what I've learned after doing research and becoming a golf nut is that Castro built homes on top of golf courses that existed, including apparently quite good Donald Ross in Havana. But so, you know, it's not a sport that he considered, you know, to align with communism. So he got rid of it. So golf was not something. All the other sports I always loved. And I wanted to be a basketball player. And those who know me know I stopped growing at 5'5", so that didn't work out. But when I was, you know, about 11 years old, we got political asylum. And that's a story in itself that could take a podcast. So we're not going to get into that. But we had the great fortune to get political asylum, to leave Cuba legally, and go to Atlanta, Georgia. And so now it's 1995, still no golf. But I loved basketball. I played in high school. Then I wasn't good enough to play in varsity. And then I figured, hey, I'm Cuban. I can play baseball. So then I started playing baseball. I wasn't so good at hitting the ball.
Wait, just one quick question. I can't let that pass. You played, did you say basketball?
I played basketball. And it's funny that, Jimmy, now we're watching The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan 10-part documentary. You know what got me into basketball was that famous shot against the Lakers in the finals when he went up and he switched hands, and that shaped my life. When I saw that, I wanted to become a basketball player. I was like 7 or 8, and the kicker here and the messed up part is in Cuba, there wasn't much basketball, but we got to see that finals, and the whole world knew who Michael Jordan was, and I don't want to get too off track, but we had these wine barrels in our backyard that had these metal rings. So I convinced my dad as a 7-year-old to nail one of these to a post that was in the corner of our house. Our house was on the corner of a street. And then the messed up part is that soon there would be 5-on-5 games on this corner, dirt corner, and they wouldn't let me play because it'd be, you know, older kids. I'd have to wait till nighttime so I could shoot a couple hoops. But that shaped me, and I think that had a lot to do with getting me to where I am today, because it made me want to have a life as a professional in sports.
And Mario, you know, before we continue, when you switched to baseball, you know, how far did you excel in that sport? Because, you know, obviously there's got to be some serious hand-eye coordination going on with you to get to where you got to.
Absolutely. So I played JV basketball. I mean, Jimmy, maybe, you know, the fact that Jimmy, we lived in these apartments in Toco Hills, which is near Emory. And then we moved to Tucker, Georgia, which is where I went to high school, Tucker High School. And it's a very competitive school athletically. And I played JV basketball. I sat on the bench my 10th grade year. And then when you go to 11th grade, you have to, you know, play varsity. And I wasn't good enough to play varsity. So I had to go straight to varsity baseball. I tried out. And I think I made the team a little bit because of my hustle. I was probably to the coach kind of the Rudy type. You know, I just worked so hard. And I played baseball as a kid, you know, before 11 years old in Cuba. Not organized, but we used to just get a rock and roll it with tape until it was round enough and it wouldn't hurt someone, and a broomstick. So I figure I'm a baseball player, and I was able to make varsity baseball in my first tryout. And what's funny about that is that I could not hit. I had, now that I know about yips through golf, I probably had the equivalent of the golf yips for hitting, meaning I would decide I was going to swing for the pitch before the pitcher threw it. And I would, no matter. So that led to some wild swings, but I was really, really good at fielding the ball. So I was a center fielder, and I started, we had a team that made a state run, and they would just DH for me. They, you know, we had some really good, including one guy that made it to the majors. But anyways, so it turned out.
How did you get from, you started out in Cuba, and how did you get from Cuba to Atlanta? And I've seen those apartments you're talking about over by Emory.
Yeah, exactly. So the short version is when Castro took over, in Cuba, you know, he took a lot of land and property from people who were prosperous. And that happened to be my grandfather on my dad's side. Everything was taken for him. So if you're on that side of the coin, you hate communism. And fast forward to the, I guess it was the 70s, my dad and his brothers were put into a working camp for standing up against communism. And then fast forward another 20 something years in 1994, there was a press release from the United States through the Swiss embassy in Havana that if you could prove that you'd been politically oppressed, you could file for political asylum. And my mom, who keeps documents and things like that, had my dad's ID cards from this working camp. And she filed, sent a letter. And within a year, we had tickets. Actually, we're going to be flown to Chicago, Illinois. And luckily, we had some relatives in Atlanta that said, no, they can stay with us. So it's called claiming. They claimed us. So we lost the housing and the food stamps that we were going to be provided, but we got to stay. We didn't even have to go to Chicago where we knew nobody, and we sure would have died simply because it's so cold, you know?
So take us from your stint with high school baseball to, because I think we're like kind of in the mid-90s now, to the year 2000 when you first touched a golf club. Take us through that part of your story.
Right. So this is I graduated high school in 2002. So this is probably like 99 or so. It was 2004 when I first started playing golf, and we're going to get there quickly. I loved baseball, but I wasn't good enough to play. I wasn't good enough to hit a pitch, you know, other than batting practice, and I wasn't good enough to play in college. So then, you know, that was it. I went on to Valdosta State University in Valdosta, Georgia, as just a college student. I wasn't good enough to play baseball on that team. So I was just going to focus on academics for the first time in my life, because I realized, wow, I'm actually going to have to pay for school for the first time. My parents didn't have a lot of money. So I took out the loans and I started applying myself. And that led to figuring out, wow, school's really expensive. And I'm building quite a debt here. And I learned that I could become an RA, a resident assistant in the dorms. It's a really hard job to get, but I was able to get the job my sophomore year in college. Which, what does an RA mean? It means you're in charge of a floor. So you're looking after making sure guys are not drinking and you know, causing trouble. But that led to not only getting a weekly paycheck, living for free in college, but it led to me meeting these couple of kids on my floor that happened to be playing the Tiger Woods video game on their Xbox. And that was the first time I had experienced golf from a standpoint of seeing highlights on SportsCenter of Tiger Woods. But I just had a perception, opinion of golf that it was for the rich people, old people. But Tiger, seeing the fist pumps definitely intrigued me.
Yeah, and didn't that version of the game have Justin Timberlake in it also?
I think it did.
Because that's my vintage too.
Yeah, so did you build yourself an avatar that looked just like you? And that was my intro to golf on great courses was Tiger Woods golf.
So we got to send Tiger a thank you for that, because what I remember is that for the first time I started to understand scoring and being the competitive guy, you know, that I am. That's one thing I am. I just love competition. I don't mind losing. I just want to, I'll try again. I'm not one of these guys that I lost friends from being too competitive because they couldn't take losing. When I lose, it just inspires me to figure out how I can win next time. So I started talking trash to these guys about, first it was, I'm going to beat you at your video game. And then I started really getting into it. I just always wanted to play with Tiger Woods. I didn't want to play with Timberlake or create my own. And I didn't even understand golf courses at the time that they could be different. You know, that's how naive, or lack of knowledge I had. I just knew how to tap that button, get that power boost. And then, you know, when you hit it, the pin seeker and all that good stuff. And that led me to talking trash to these guys like, oh, this is easy. Like, I can beat you in real golf.
So how long from that point to being on a real golf course
So that is, you know, we've talked, Jimmy, and I've told you when we met, like the moment when we met, which led to you playing Quaker and us becoming friends, that this question you asked me is one of those moments. So now I'm like, I have this challenge that, because the guy said, you can't beat us at golf, you're crazy. So that's my challenge now. So I get on eBay at the time. I was a big eBayer. And I realized that a set of clubs cost a couple $100s, right? And I thought to myself, well, I only have $75 in my checking account. I'm never going to play golf. This is just crazy that you have to pay this kind of money just to be able to play, right?
Yeah.
So
just to get the equipment to play.
So that was that like really, I was like a letdown. I was like, well, I go back, can I use yours? I said, no, they don't let you play. You got to bring your own club. So at that point, you know, I thought, well, I'm probably never really going to play golf. And then here's where the moment that I'm talking about. In Valdosta, Georgia, a population of 20,000 people, there's like three super Walmarts within like, you know, it's like everywhere. It's like Waffle Houses across the street in Atlanta. There's Walmarts everywhere. So our saying in Valdosta was, if Walmart doesn't have it, you don't need it. So I would go there to buy groceries. I would go there to get whatever I needed. So I went to this Walmart and I got what I needed. I have no idea what it was, but I remember getting in my car and pulling out. Now, this is really crazy because I had just walked by this and didn't notice, but I looked through my rearview mirror, make sure I'm not going to hit anybody. And I see this huge banner that says clearance. And the first thing that came to my mind was, maybe they have golf clubs. So I had a decision to make and I just pulled the car back in. And I went and walked to this outside clearance, which to this day, I've never seen an outside the store clearance at Walmart. I don't frequent Walmart as often anymore, and I go straight to a box. Now this is funny because I'm like, I cannot believe the box says Northwestern. It says driver through whatever. And I called my buddies who I played video games with. And I said, hey, guys, I'm here at Walmart. There's a set of clubs. You know, they're $50. Should I buy them? Is it a good deal? And they said, well, what brand is it? And I said, it's Northwestern. And I was so excited because I had just read on the box, it said the best golf brand in the world. And they said, well, we've never heard of Northwestern, but it's $50. Just buy it. I went and made the decision that I could afford these clubs, go inside the store. And the lady says, oh, these are actually an extra. They have an orange sticker on the box. These are an extra 50% off. So my first set of clubs was a set of Northwestern titanium heads with the iron said titanium heads on them. And they were $25.
Wow. So now you have a set of golf clubs. What's next? Any lessons?
So now I got a set of clubs. I take them out of the box. I lay them on the bed. I'm telling you guys, these are the most beautiful things that I've ever seen in my life. You know, now I own a set of clubs, and I've kept the 8-iron. Let me tell you, it is one ugly looking club. But I remember. I remember thinking, wow, these are just so beautiful. And I call my friends over and they, you know, and I remember one of them said, well, you need a bag and you need a putter. So back to Walmart. I didn't have enough money. There was a bag on sale for $29. I called my sister who would help me out. And I said, I need some money, put some money in my account. I need to buy this golf bag. And the putter was like that black and white Spalding putter, you know. And I bought it. And then it turns out another RA father in Valdosta, Georgia, there's an Air Force base golf course. Most Air Force bases, I think, have golf courses. And it's called Moody Air Force Base Quiet Pines, 9 holes. And there was another RA that, you know, that was on 2 floors below in the same building. And he was getting the golf bug. He had clubs and all that. And he taught me how to hold the club. He probably still can't break 95, but he showed me how to put my hands on the club. And he said, I'm going to take you out. I can get us on for like $15 for 9 holes because my dad's in the military. And that was it. That's, I went out and played my first hole probably the week after.
It's amazing. I just apropos of absolutely nothing, but which actually is the name of our next podcast, apropos of absolutely nothing. I just Googled Northwestern golf clubs. You can still get a whole set, you know, on eBay, but it's not $50 anymore. Not really. It's eight. It looks like the best deal is set $79, but,
inflation.
But, I'm just looking at them and they look pretty much like they're Ping I 2 knockoffs, right?
Don't you think? God. Yeah. They were if you have some notes, those podcasts have, we'll leave notes at the end, a link with notes. We should like attach a picture. I should try to find that 8 iron.
Yeah, no, I can see it online. It looks sweet. I can see why you got really hooked on golf with Northwestern.
I got to tell you guys the first time I went out. This guy's name is Brad. Brad takes me out to the Moody Air Force Base. I remember shooting, we played 9 twice. You just play from different tees. And I didn't know how to count. So there was countless times when I swung and I missed, or I topped, or I, of course, those didn't count as strokes. And there was plenty of times when I hit it OB.
You mean they count now?
Depends who you're playing with. But there was the reason I kept the 8 iron is because on one of the holes, I made a swing. And this was like probably 15th or 16th hole of the day, and I thought I missed because it was the first time there was no vibration in my hands, and it was the most, it felt like, you know, how they describe as, you know, the sweet spot, like butter. And I really thought I missed. I look up and this ball is going right at the green, and I remember saying to myself, I'm gonna be a golf nut and I'm gonna play golf for the rest of my life. And It was a life-changing moment. I just knew that this was now going to be my mission, to try to figure out how to repeat that feeling over and over again.
So I remember the first time I struck a ball too, and it flew, and you don't hear it, you don't really hear it very much, and you don't feel it. And then it's just one of the sweetest things, and that hooked me too the first time. A ball I swung at actually took flight and soared off into the sky.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's, you know, it's just, it's life changing. That's the only thing I could say.
Now you're hooked.
Now I'm hooked.
You're hooked. And so after you're hooked, how long does it take for you to get back out on the golf course again? And then where do you go from there?
Well, if there's golf gods and golf is a religion, I have sinned. And early on, I sinned because it was a drug to me. And I just then, before I get into my golf sins, to ask your question, you know, those clubs, by the way, only lasted with me for like 3 months, but let's go back to answer your question. Then we'll get into that. I figured out that I cut my hair really short, and I became really friendly with the lady in the golf shop, that I could show up and I could just make small talk with her.
Ricky Ricardo.
and then there was a big board that showed all the classifications of being in the Air Force, and they all had different price assigned to it. And the basic level is an A1. And, you know, I'm like, yeah, I'm here to play 9 after we talked for a while. How are you? How are your kids? How, blah, blah, blah. And then she would always ask me, what's your classification? I look at the board and I would just say, A1. Because, and here's how I justified it. It was like $7 to play 9 holes if I was an A1. And if I was just a civilian, as they call it, it was $30, right? But I figured, you're going to get this is my justification. I'm going to be back tomorrow and give you another $7. You're going to get my $30. $30 for me, but I'm going to play every day. And so I became good friends with her. And eventually I had to admit that I had been, not actually an A1, but, we laughed it off. And, And that was really, that led to me going out there, carrying my bag and playing golf and getting better and better and better. And within 1 year, I broke 80 at Moody Air Force Base. And I remember I definitely cried.
I mean, that's insane, by the way. Like, I've been playing since eighth grade and I've broken 80 one time.
You know, I actually broke 80 in my second year of playing golf. I shot a 79 and then didn't break 90 for another year and a half.
Wow.
It's funny how when you break 80, it's always a 79 and there's always something that has to happen where, you know, it just 80 just doesn't feel so good. I have to say something, Aaron. We've played a couple times, but you've always kind of told me how bad of a golfer you are, and we played and you shot like a smooth 82. Like, you're a lot better than you put yourself out to be, and it's only a matter of time.
I'm gonna be texting you later for some lessons, Mario. Don't you worry. Okay, so we're playing on the Air Force course here in college, and you know, you're starting to excel at it. Obviously, hitting under 80 after a year is saying something. The golf god is saying something to you. Keep going. So then, I guess let's maybe fast forward a few years. You graduate college, and what happens from here? What's the next stage of your story here?
Well, I don't want to skip over. I know we have a limited time, but here's what happens next. What happens next is that I kind of, you know, realized that even though $25 was a lot to pay for a set of clubs, within like 3 months, I have saved enough money to where I paid $300 for a set of tailor-made clubs, and how quickly that changes, right? Where all of a sudden 300 is, what a deal. And then I find out that there's a new course in town being built, a championship golf course. And I go and I apply for a job and they hire me as a cart guy. So now I'm an RA. I'm a cart guy at Kinderloo Forest. And that was another one of those life changing moments that allowed me to keep going and keep getting better, because the golf team, the Valdosta State University golf team, that's their home course. So that's where they practice. So I'm a big believer that you find winners and you copy them, right? If you want to be better. And I would literally, I thought these guys were the coolest dudes in the world, and I would became friends with them. I would ask them if I could play with them, and then I would try to copy the talk, the walk, the whole thing. And so I had a pretty fast track education into going, you know, from never touching the club to at least looking the part, acting the part, and seeing people play golf at a high level.
This is Jimmy. We had a small technical glitch and missed Mario telling us how frightened he was doing his first tournament. We're going to pick up with the next question.
So, Mario, you know, your hand shaking in that tournament was how I felt when we stood on the first tee at Quaker Ridge. I was cold. I was tired. And scared. So I know the feeling. But apparently you did a better job of overcoming all of that than I did. And so he told you that there was tournament golf and there's regular golf. And
yes.
What happened after that?
I think that's a famous Bobby Jones quote. There's golf and there's tournament golf and the two are not alike. Can you use that on me? And that inspired me to sign up for as many tournaments, because I knew I could now play. And I knew that I could. The deal was, if I break 75 from the back tees, I'm good enough to get a golf bag with my name, no scholarship or anything. And then, you know, that summer I got a credit card and I built a little debt just signing up for anything I could play in that I could pay for. And by the time that I got an opportunity to try out again, I wasn't as nervous and I could actually play. And then I got a spot on the team, and that allowed me to keep going a little bit longer. I played in the 2006-2007 season. I only qualified for one tournament, and it just happened to be in Hawaii at Mount Aulani, and a beautiful course. But that's just kind of the story of my life, you know, just getting a little bit further along. And you know, just copying these guys and getting better and better.
Wait, so Mario, let me get the time frame right here. You started playing golf when?
In 2004.
Okay, and by 2006, you were playing college golf?
I was playing college golf by 2006.
Yeah, that's insane.
I am better now. I'm better now because I kind of know how to fix my bad shots, and I'm not going to hit some wild off the planet shot. But I remember then, every time I was over the ball, even though a lot of times it was a good shot and I could shoot low scores, I had no idea where the ball was going to go or why it went where it went.
up to this point, your friend who can't break 90 teaches you how to grip the club, which is obviously very important. But you'd had no formal lessons. You just watched, you observed, and replicated.
Well, I also got my hands on any book that I could, and I know we'll get to this, but I remember buying the Jim McClain books, and at the time he was on the Golf Channel, and of course now he's been a huge part of my professional life, being a Jim McClain teaching disciple, and I learned so much from him. And I remember watching him. So indirectly, I was getting lessons. You know, you hear Bubba when he won the Masters saying, "Oh, I've never had a lesson." That's a bunch of crap, and I've always had a problem with it, because you may have never like signed up and put your name in someone's book and paid them for the hourly, but come on, Bubba, you've been getting lessons your whole life. We're always getting a golf lesson, right? Your buddy says, you know, get through the shot, or you read something in a magazine. That's what a golf lesson is, right?
Yeah.
I had a lot of that. I had as much of that as I could get my hands on.
Let me just interject a quick advertisement here for our sponsor, and I'll go quick, but I just want to thank the folks at LinkSoul who have been kind enough to help support Jimmy and I as we do this podcast. If our listeners could be kind enough, LinkSoul makes some really nice, comfy clothes. You can wear them, you know, playing golf, and you can wear them just hanging around the house even. And if you get on the LinkSoul website, you'll see what I mean. And there's a code that if you put it in, when you're buying something on the site, it's GN20, so Golf Nut 20, GN20. You put that in. I keep forgetting what the discount is. It's something like 10-15%. It'll tell you when you enter it. But it's a discount code, and it helps it just helps support us as we kind of work our way through these podcasts. So we appreciate it very much. And we'll get back to Mario Guerra now. Jimmy, where do we leave off here in the story? Let's see. We're basically Mario, through college. Right? We're basically through college, I think.
Right. So you're in college, you're on the team, and you're getting to go to some great places to play golf. And did you play, I assume you played for 2 additional years?
I didn't. I only had 1 season on the golf team, and then it was time to graduate. So once I graduated, you know, I remained working at the golf course, but I had a business degree, and one of the gentlemen who was a member of the golf course offered me a job in sales, and I did that for a while, but I really missed golf. And everybody told me in Valdosta, Georgia, "Mario, if you love golf, don't become a golf pro. You won't make any money and you won't play any golf." So I wanted to make some money and I wanted to play a lot of golf. So I kind of listened for a while, but then I decided, you know what? I don't care anymore. I'm going to be a golf pro. I want to be around it. I don't want to be in sales. I don't want to be in marketing. I want to just be in golf. And it for me was bad timing, because by now it's 2008 and the economy is crashing. So I was sending applications to clubs in Florida. I was still in Georgia, but my family lived in Miami by now, and no one was even replying to me for an assistant pro job.
So how did your life get sorted out in 2008?
So this is how it gets, you know, to where I am today. I was pretty much in what you would call a rut. I was trying to figure out my life. I didn't want to do what I'd studied in school. And what you do during those times, right? You go and you go be around family. So I went to Miami to be around my family just to figure out my life. And this is by now, fast forward a little bit, it's It's around October. I go to Miami and I said, I'm not playing golf at all. I just want to be around my family, figure my life out. But one day everybody's at work. I'm sitting home by myself and I'm like, I got to go play golf. So I go to this public course called Palmetto Golf Course in Miami with my Valdosta State, you know, bag with my name on it, this hotshot guy. And it's so busy, you can't play by yourself, right? I mean, both you guys have met some incredible people along the way. So you know how this story goes. They paired up with this guy and, you know, he says, what's your story? And I said, you know, I'm Mario. I was playing college golf. I'm here visiting my family and I'm here for a couple of weeks. He said, well, I'm the chairman of volunteers for the Miccosukee Championship. Now, the Miccosukee Championship was at the time, a nationwide tour event, which is what today is the Korn Ferry Tour in Miami, Florida. And this, so I just ended up playing with this guy and he says, if you want, you can be a you can volunteer. I'll let you do whatever you want. You want to be on the range? You want to be a walking scorer? And I had the decision to make. I just want to be home. But I said, you know what? I'll do it. I mean, this is like amazing for me. I get to be around tour players. And that led me to agreeing to be a volunteer. And then this is what happened. After I did my training, I paid my $50, which you get a shirt and shoes. Anyone who's volunteer, you know, you got to pay to volunteer. And right. the next day after my training, which was, I did training Saturday, on Sunday, which is the day before the tournament week starts, he calls me, his name is Ernie, and he says, forget volunteering, the Golf Channel is looking for a runner. And I just met you, but I think you would be great. They'll pay you $12 an hour. And I said, Ernie, what about volunteering? He said, no, just, this is better. I said, okay, I'm in.
Just real quickly, Mario, I'll interject. Not only do you have to pay when you volunteer for those tournaments, for the volunteer pack, you have to pay before you know whether you'll be selected.
Yeah, I had an in knowing the chairman of volunteers, you know, but still, I knew, I was like, wait, you didn't tell me I was going to have to pay for this. But I was like, it just goes to show you the moral here is that if you say no to things, you close the door. If I had said, no, I don't want to pay $50, I thought I was just volunteer, then I'd never be sitting here talking to you guys. But I said yes. And so the tournament week starts. I'll tell you
I got a quick sidebar question. What does a runner mean? What does that mean?
Exactly. I said, what does that mean? And he said, I don't know. So I show up on Monday as a runner and he introduced me to my boss, this lady named Chris. And she says, your job, once tournament week starts, your job is to run tape. Like we're live on TV. You're going to have to do whatever we need. You're a runner. You just run over there, run over here. You just, whatever we need you to do, you're a runner. And it's a term they use in media, I guess, in production. So it's like the lowest bottom of the podium total person that you could have, I guess, on the compound, you know? And she says, and that's going to be your job starting on Thursday. But right now your job is to fill these water coolers with ice, fill them with drinks. And you see that box of banners, there's all these big box of banners and zip ties that said Golf Channel on them. She said, you know, every three holes, we have these towers for the cameras. I need you to put those banners on those towers. And then off I went. I knew the course. I had played the course before. She told me where to start. So I come back. I mean, I'm literally almost dying here. It's windy. I've got one zip. Think of a banner. I mean, these are 12 by 12. They're huge and it's windy. I'm up there in these towers and I got one corner. I get the other corner. I come in kind of disappointed in myself at dark. I started probably around like 11 a.m. So it's like 7 hours later. And I said, I'm sorry. It took me so long. And she said, what do you mean? I said, you know, I just finished now. I said, you finished? She's like, it took the guy last week all the way to Thursday. She said, hold on a second. Like, what's your story? Who are you? And I said, no, I'm just Mario. I want to be a golf pro. And she said, okay, I tell you what. This guy named Michael Breed that does one course announcing for us. And he is the best guy. And apparently he's a heck of a teacher and a head pro at quite the club in New York at Sunningdale. I never heard of Michael Breed. I never heard of Sunningdale, but she says, I think that it would be great if instead of running, I can get a different runner. You just drive him around for the week and it might lead to something. And
amazing. So now you're driving Michael Breed around for the week as your job. You've gone from you've gone from being a volunteer,
yeah,
to being a runner where you never really got to run.
No.
to being Michael Breed's driver at a PGA event.
At a PGA Tour, basically, you know, I mean, anybody that knows golf, these guys are guys that are on tour, they go back or upcoming. I mean, these guys can play some golf. This is a nationwide tour. And if anybody listening knows Michael and knows he's the greatest guy in the world, and as soon as he meets me, he says, you know, I'm in the cart. By now, I've done my research. I Googled him. I know he's a top 100 teacher. And I know all about Sunningdale. I'd never even been to New York at the time. So I'm in Miami. And as soon as he gets in the cart, he says, what's your name? And I said, I'm Mario. And he goes, all right, Super Mario, take me to the first hole. So we hit it off. And then he didn't say a whole lot. But what I figured out, point me where I needed to go. He liked to be on the ground most of the time, but I was there near in case we needed action was happening on another hole. He'd jump in the cart. So he was working, you know, and I happened to get the same headphones that he had. And when he wasn't talking, you know, commentating on live TV, he was like cracking up. So I figured out which channel they were on, and it was Jerry Foltz and Kurt Byram and Michael Breed just talking trash to each other. So I'm like, I just died and went to heaven. You know, I'm a golf nut, and I'm at this nationwide tour event, and I have the inside the ropes listening to what these guys would do, the announcing. Jerry Foltz and Kurt Byram are in the booth. Michael's on the ground, and they're just, you know, ripping shots at each other. And then Michael gets back in the cart after the first day, and he says, what's your story? And I said, well, I want to be a golfer. I want to be the best head golf professional that I can be. And he laughed, and he said, okay, well, then bring me your resume. And I had a resume ready because I'd been sending it out, as I mentioned, and no one had replied. And that's what happened.
So what's interesting in the sense of the you and I kindred spirits, I think, you know, this is your first podcast. My first podcast was with Michael Breed. And the reason my first podcast, you may not, I think when Michael called me at 6:30 that morning, no, it wasn't a podcast. It was on his show,
yeah,
his morning show on the Golf Channel. He called me at the phone rings at 6:30 in the morning. And he says, Jimmy, I got your name from Mario Gura.
Yeah.
Can you do an interview in 30 minutes?
Yeah, I remember him calling because I, of course, when we met Jimmy, I called him, you know, he's like a second father to me. And I told him, and he's the kind of guy that this is his life is also a little bit like this. So that's, you know, when I called you to say, I said, Jimmy, who are you? What's your story? You know, that's Michael's line. And he's all about a story and a meeting like that. So as soon as that happened between you and I called him and I said, you're not going to believe what happened. Yeah. So the next day, you know, to get through that real quick is the next day he comes back and I had my resume ready and I had things to do with the compound. I still had to do my running job. I still had to fill the water coolers and all that stuff. And Michael, I didn't get to see him till 1 o'clock when we were about to go on the course. And I thought he would have forgotten about that. He asked me for my resume. But as soon as he got in the cart, he says, hey, Super Mario, where's that resume? And I'm like, it's in the car. He said, well, go get it. You know, then that whole day went by and then he got back in the cart. You know, he put the resume in his bag and then he got back in the cart after that day. Again, he doesn't say a whole lot to me except where does he need to go? And he says, you know what? I have an outside operations job at Sunningdale open. Would you be willing to relocate to New York? And I said, for the right job, I'll do anything. And it's in golf. And I knew it was a heck of an opportunity. And he said, you know, I'm going to take care of you. And I said, I'm in. And this is around October of 2009.
It's incredible. I had no idea. You know, I didn't even know the connection to Sunningdale with Michael Breed, and I didn't know your connection. I mean, I know who Michael Breed is, you know, just from media, just from seeing TV and such, but I didn't know your connection. So, I guess if we can just kind of quickly move forward now, I think we're kind of at the crux of it. You know, now you're working as an outside attendant, which I realize is you're not even an assistant pro yet, but,
right.
you know, at some point, someone must have given you a shot to start teaching juniors or something. Or like, how did it transition from you just being one of the guys helping people get their clubs out of the car and do stuff like that to actually being on the tee box and teaching kids or teaching people?
Right. So Michael Breed hires me and I tell him who I want to become. He says, well, I don't have a teaching job, but I have this job. And I said, yes. And then I come up to New York and work in the bag room at Sunningdale. And it just turns out that he also told me, look, in the wintertime, I can get you a job at the Jim McLean Golf Schools. And he did get me a job. And he said, trust me, you're going to go down there. You're going to learn how to teach. So I went and worked for the Jim McLean Golf Schools in La Quinta, PGA West. And while this is happening, while I'm learning how to teach, the second assistant leaves for a better opportunity. And Michael Breed says, you know, you're my guy. You're going to be the second assistant. And that means that I can now teach.
So this is back at, you come back, you work with Jim McLean, then you come back to Sunningdale to New York.
That's right.
And now you have a promotion.
I have a promotion. Over the winter, he called me and he said, you're getting promoted. Get ready. Explain to me what my role was going to be. And that really, that's what once I came through that door and I could start teaching, then I really, for one, now I knew a little bit of what I was doing. You don't, the first 5 years you teach, you feel like every year you get better and you feel like you should give some refunds. So, I mean, at the time I thought I knew what I was doing, but every year I would learn more and say, oh my God, I really screwed Jimmy up. I really should offer an apology. But if you're nice enough and care about people, they stick with you and then you may have an opportunity to actually help them get better. And then I moved on to first assistant there and I was there, even after Michael left. And
so how many years did you spend at Sunningdale?
I spent 6 years at Sunningdale and in 2005, six seasons. And in 2015, a good buddy of mine, Andrew Bostrom, was working as an assistant at Quaker Ridge. And I always thought, for those of you who know, I always thought Sunningdale and Quaker Ridge were a bit of sister clubs. And I always thought, obviously, Quaker Ridge, in my opinion, would be the only place I would leave Sunningdale for, because I loved Sunningdale. I loved the membership. I loved being there. It's basically where I grew up as a pro, if you want to say that, even though I'm still a baby. And the opportunity came open at Quaker Ridge, and I felt I needed to go for it. And then that led to where I am today. I was an assistant for Brian Gaffney, hired me. And then when he left, I got the opportunity to become the head pro. And it's been a heck of a ride, and it's been life-changing to say the least, but it's given me purpose. I love teaching. I always just wanted to be a teacher once I really got into it. But when the opportunity to be the head golf professional at Quaker Ridge came up, I knew I had to take it. And it also allowed me, when you're an assistant pro, you're always leaving. If you get really good, you're leaving. If you're not very good, they kick you out, you know, and then you get to teach. Like Aaron has a son, Teddy, who I gave his first golf lesson to. I have a video of that. But if I'm the head pro and I left at Quaker Ridge, I'm going to get to go on a golf trip to Scotland with Teddy, hopefully one day.
Yeah.
But if I'm assistant pro, I'm leaving. And, you know, I may never see Teddy again. So I those are one of the things that I thought about when I decided, you know what, even though now I had already become like a, you know, a known teacher and a skilled teacher, and I could go the director of instruction route, and being a head pro, that's a whole new set of skills that you have to develop.
So you started there and you said 2015
was my first season.
2015. And that allowed you and me to meet, I think, on like the 8th of May.
Of my first year. Yeah, of my first year as a head pro. That's one of the things. If I was still an assistant pro teaching 9 hours a day, we would have never met, because even if a caddy came running to me at the lesson tee, we have an accident, I radioed the head pro and said, you know, you got an accident, buddy.
let me interject, because I think this is a very nice place to conclude the podcast. I want you guys to talk about how you met. You're alluding to it, and I know the story, of course. But why don't we finish up with this serendipitous moment that really involves the three of us in different ways. And it's just it's a great sort of microcosm of what golf is. And now we're all friends. But I don't know from which perspective is better, Jimmy's or well, Mario's.
I'll start, and Mario can pick up when I walk up to him. But I'm trying. I'm playing the top 100 in a year. I'm down to the last 28 courses. I have 34 days left to get 28 spread across the country left, and I finish up around at Wingfoot, and I'm headed out to Long Island, and I'm driving down Griffin Street, and I see this tall guy by a truck with a crack in the windshield, and there are these guys with golf attire, and he's yelling at them, and so I pull over, I observe for a while, the guy gets in the truck. And when he gets in the truck, I think he's leaving, but he was actually just moving the truck off the road. And so I just walk up to these guys with a big smile on my face. And I say, it's unfortunate what's happened here today. But in every dark cloud, there's a silver lining. I want to be your silver lining. I'm trying to play the top 100 courses in a year. I'm running out of my year. And I point over at Quaker Ridge and I say, and I need to play that one on Saturday.
So Mario,
you can pick it up from there.
I've been called there because, we have an outing going on. And one of the golfers from the outing, not even a member, sliced ball on our eighth hole into a truck's windshield. So I get called out there because the traffic is backing up. The course is backing up. I'm trying to mediate. I'm trying to use those RA skills I learned, from mediation in college, and trying to convince the guy in the truck to pull into the club. And I look at traffic that's going, kind of being nosy, seeing what's happening. And I make eye contact with Jimmy, and I just like, I'm looking at him. He's looking at me. We had a moment. And then I notice he pulled over into someone's driveway, and then he's crossing the street. And I'm thinking, oh, what the heck is going on? And just as he said, he came right up to us, extended his hand, said who he was, what he was trying to do. And I said, listen, man, you got to get out of here. I got my hands full, but I can help you. I'm the golf pro here. Give me your name and number. I saved it. I called him so that I wouldn't forget to call him back. And as you know now from listening to this podcast, because I'm such a big believer in fate and these moments, I knew I had to help this guy out. And I knew it was not a coincidence that he had seen this accident, walked across the street, and that I had to be there at that time for him to get to play Quaker Ridge.
It's amazing. It's amazing hearing all that happened, all that the golf gods did to get you to the point to where you could be at that moment,
right,
standing there so you could help me achieve playing the top 100 golf courses in a year.
Yeah, Jimmy. It's all about Jimmy. It's all about you.
But
I have to say, I have to say, really crazy is that now when I need to get a Quakerish member on a course that I can't get them on, I call Jimmy.
So it goes complete circle that all of that stuff I did was so that I could be available to help you get your members onto courses around the country. Now the other part of this, three amigos here, is Aaron. So I get an email from a guy, and I write him back, and we call and we start to talk, and it turns out he tells me his name, and he says, "Yeah, I read your article, and the day you stopped on the street, an article in Golf Digest told the story we just told." He said, "It was a tournament that I hold each year that was going on. And one of my friends, is the guy who hit the ball over the fence." And so I got a chance to meet Matt Goldman, who was the guy that had the incident that led to us coming together. And also as a result, led to the three of us becoming friends.
It's interesting. I've got this golf blog too, Breaking 10,000, and it has a has my email address on it, which it's amazing. I get emails all the time from people who look at the blog, and it's always the same question. It's always the same question. Jimmy, I'm sure you get the same question in your blog. How do you get on all these top 100 golf courses? And, you know, I think this story is evidence of how the heck it works. I mean, it's a lot of coincidence, and it's a lot of just being a good person, and it's a lot of being as helpful as you can be. The fact that Jimmy has been so helpful to Mario, to reciprocate to the favor of Mario getting Jimmy out on the course as a stranger, you know, that's kind of what it's all about. And it's as simple as that. It's the normal sort of golden rule of life. Just try to be as helpful as you can to people. I spend so much time trying to help people get out on golf courses, connecting people. And you just hope the golf gods, again, to the religious element of golf, just help you out. They just help you out. And, you know, I also say this, Jimmy had this article written about him in Golf Digest. He just finished the top 100 in a calendar year. And I reached out to him on his blog, and he wrote back immediately. And the thing is, it's just a human being, two-legged human being on the other end of all of this stuff. And Jimmy and I found a time to play golf and have really played many, many times since. So it's hard, but it's also easy. You just got to put yourself out there a little bit.
Absolutely.
And one of the stories you told Mario, how you're a part of your journey and meeting the gentleman on the first tee at the course there in Florida. And that's what I would also advise people to do, is to show up at courses sometimes by yourself and get paired. It's amazing the people you'll meet, the amazing people you'll meet, and the stories they have.
Absolutely.
And to finish on that point, when you play golf with someone, golf reveals someone's character and who they are as a person. And in a round of golf, you're going to see how they handle success, how they handle embarrassment, adversity, all of the things that life throws at you. So you'll quickly find out what people are made of and who they are. And if you ever even want to play golf with them again. But for the most part, you end up making a friend that typically lasts a lifetime and can help you, and someone that you'll be able to help as well.
Well, Mario, thank you so much for giving us your time today and telling us your story. And I really look forward to future conversations with you and just getting to know you better. It was a real treat. And I look forward to seeing you soon.
Sounds good. Thank you so much, Aaron, for having me on. And Jimmy, it's been great. It's been great fun. So I can't wait to hear all the other episodes you guys have in store for us. Thanks again.
Thanks, Mario.
Awesome. Bye.
Take care. Bye.
Hi, Jimmy.
Hey, Aaron. What a great discussion with Mario. And I think some wonderful stories and just the friendship that the three of us have developed.
Yeah, it's such a funny thing that the way the three of us have intersected, and really some of the parallels between your life and Mario's life. And, you know, I think it's really a misunderstanding about golf that people think it's an elite sport. You have to grow up in a certain type of household to enjoy the game. And it's so nice to see the passion you have for the game and the passion that Mario has from the game, given that you guys grew up so far away from the game. And it's awesome. And we, you know, you, me, and Mario should play some golf together. So you only played with him one time, right?
I played with him one time.
Okay, yeah. You know, it's really frustrating because you can tell from this story here, the part of the story that doesn't quite make sense is that he picked up the club and then 2 years later he's playing college golf. Now, what I've heard, and I didn't want to ask him about this on the podcast, maybe on a future podcast, but apparently he is like the sickest ping pong player ever. I think his hand-eye coordination is off the charts, this guy.
It has to be to hit a pure shot like he hit during his very first round of playing golf. You know how long it took me after trying to hit a golf ball to get up the courage to even go out on right. a golf course?
Yeah. So this guy is, it's an incredible story, but there's some athleticism that, you know, push him to hit, go under 70, under 80 after his first year of playing. I mean, that's just nuts. That is crazy. But, anyway, I cannot wait for the three of us to go play some golf. So looking forward to that, Jimmy.
It'll be fun. I hope everyone enjoyed just, hearing a conversation among three friends that are pure golf nuts.
Absolutely. All right. Talk to you soon.